what is war and what is crime and what's the difference? And we have Malcolm Thornburn's paper from Toronto, where he's on the faculty of law, and then our respondent is Adam Humphreys from Reading, and we will go from there.
Thanks, Heather. Well, let me start by thanking Helen and Jonathan very much for inviting me. It's great fun. And thanks to Malcolm for such an interesting paper. As will become apparent, I don't think the argument quite works in its current form, and I'll try and lay out at least why I think that. But I found it really interesting to go through, and I think it raises lots of really interesting issues, and I'll try and elaborate, if I have time, a little bit at the end about some of the directions that this paper might push our thinking. So in a sense, the starting point is fairly familiar territory. We're thinking about the incompatibility or the alleged incompatibility between international humanitarian law and the interpersonal morality governing the use of force, at least as viewed through the lens of self-defense. But Malcolm's coming at this from what is, at least to me, quite an original, interesting perspective. So he's coming from the direction of domestic law and legal theory, and via that route trying to give us a distinctive interpretation of the nature and aims of international humanitarian law, and therefore give us a distinctive picture of the moral considerations that should govern what we're looking for from the law, even if that means that the law ends up in conflict with the provisions of interpersonal morality. So I'm not going to summarise the whole argument, but I'm going to just summarise the section of the argument which I think is most relevant to the considerations that come out of the paper. So Malcolm's starting by sort of saying that, you know, if we assume that the moral justifiability of law turns on its ability to replicate the structure of international morality, which is the sort of the Jeffrey Marmon position, then he sort of accepts that there's a conflict here. But what he doesn't accept is that we necessarily need to accept this starting point, so we need to accept that there's a criterion for law that it should closely track the provisions of interpersonal morality. Indeed, he wants to reject that premise. He wants to give us an alternative way of thinking about the moral justifiability of law, as I understand it. And his argument is that we should think of law not as aiming to replicate the structure of interpersonal morality, but rather as aiming at the ideal of the rule of law. In other words, the aim of law is to provide, and I quote, an institutional structure that makes it possible for persons to live together on terms that respect their fundamental moral status as free to set and pursue their own ends within a sphere of freedom that is circumscribed only by the equal demands of others' claim to equal freedom. And so what he wants to argue is that when we look at the domestic criminal law, even here, the right of self-defense is not in fact a private right. Okay. What it is a right of state officials. Individuals can use self-defense only when recourse to the state is unavailable. Moreover, state officials, and this is an important part of the argument, are permitted to engage in significantly coercive behavior that no private person may undertake in his or her own name. So when we look at domestic criminal law, which you think might be most close to the interpersonal morality of self-defense, even here there's a pretty significant gap between what the law allows and what interpersonal morality allows. And this is because of a moral requirement that we rightly place on law, that it aims to achieve the ideal of the rule of law. Okay. So understood as aiming precisely at the rule of law rather than to replicate the structure of interpersonal morality, the domestic criminal justice system may be understood as seeking roughly to create an equal playing field in which everyone is equally entitled to a freedom limited only by the equal demand of others to such freedom. And it attempts to do this by putting in place a legal structure in which any infringement of individual rights must be carried out by a public authority in the name of all. Okay. So the critical feature of domestic criminal law is that only the state has standing to legitimately make coercive demands of others, and it has this standing because it does not act on behalf of any private purpose, but rather acts to secure the rightful condition for all. And then, having sort of built this picture of the gap between the law and morality in the domestic sphere, Malcolm then wants to kind of reason to, if you like, international humanitarian law and account for the perceived gap there as well. At least that's how I understand the argument. And so what he does is to observe that this sort of sharp distinction between what state officials and private citizens may do is found analogously in international humanitarian law to how it's found in domestic criminal law. Okay. So, for example, he notes that under the jus ad bellum, war making is an activity that can only be legitimately undertaken in the name of a legitimate public authority. In other words, this is a right that's reserved to soldiers, not to private citizens. Okay. But the really crucial part of the argument is to think about standing. Who has the standing to judge the conduct of states and state officials, that is, soldiers, acting in their official capacity? Well, what he wants to argue here is that in the absence of a higher international public authority, war should not be thought of as a way of meting out justice, but rather as a form of quasi-judicial conflict resolution. In other words, the closest we can come in the absence of precisely the kind of higher public authority that we find at the domestic level. And because the ideal of the rule of law stipulates that we must have a level playing field, it cannot be arbitrarily tipped in favour of one of the disputants, the soldiers on each side must remain privileged combatants. So precisely the provision of an equal playing field, if you like, that we require as a condition of the rule of law domestically, the international analogue of that is that the soldiers on each side must remain privileged combatants, because the law is not allowed to arbitrarily tip the balance in favour of one side over the other in the course of their process of quasi-judicial dispute resolution. And so the argument he's trying to do here is to say that this is an independent moral consideration that we should apply to law, apply to our expectations about international humanitarian law, which can explain the discrepancy. It doesn't as it were do away with the provisions of interpersonal morality, but when we come to the question of what the law should look like, here is a separate moral consideration which should govern what the law should look like. Now, I don't think this argument quite works, and I'm going to lay out two areas in which I'm not quite persuaded by it. Okay. The first of which is roughly to look back at what is really going on in domestic criminal law, and the second of which is to think about the question of standing as it applies internationally. So it seems to me that if we accept Malcolm's interpretation of domestic criminal law, there's a really, really important proviso here, which is that there are places where the domestic criminal law tracks interpersonal morality quite closely and places where it departs very radically. Okay, and those are very roughly the areas of self-defense and punishment. So there are two bits of Malcolm's argument, roughly speaking. The first is that even when we act in what we think might be self-defense domestically, actually we're acting as temporary state officials. So even here, the provisions the law makes don't precisely match the provisions of interpersonal morality. And then he wants to make a further move and say, oh, and look at all these other powers that state officials have which an ordinary citizen could never have. Rights around arrest, search, detention. Okay. But it seems to me really important to note that that latter set of powers, and they're quite an extensive set of powers, is a set of powers around punishment. Okay. They're not a set of powers around self-defense. Okay, and in a sense, this is where you see the real departure of criminal law from the interpersonal morality governing self-defense, right? Is in the creation under a public authority of a whole set of what you might think of as juridical rights, which go way beyond what you could ever have as part of a system of natural morality governing self-defense, right? So the juridical rights of punishment simply have no place in a sort of interpersonal morality of self-defense. And it seems to me that this is the point at which domestic criminal law departs furthest from, if you like, the provisions of interpersonal morality. And moreover, it's precisely in respect of these kind of juridical rights possessed by state officials, which can never be exercised by private citizens, that the question of standing is most important. Okay, so it is here, it is in relation to rights of search, arrest, detention, punishment, etc., that any infringement of individual rights must be carried out by a duly constituted public authority. Right? We take this is absolutely crucial. So this is where the question of standing becomes very, very important, because this is what ensures that any infringement is consistent with the rule of law. But this seems to me, this exposes a problem with the reasoning by analogy from the domestic to the international, because by definition, when we're talking about war, we're talking about acts of self-defense, purportedly, rather than acts of punishment, right? So noting that there are all these rights of punishment which exist and in relation to which questions of legal standing are absolutely crucial at the domestic level, there's a question about how much this tells us about the international level where there is no real analogue, certainly in the absence of duly constituted public authorities. So it seems to me that if Malcolm wants to present an argument about sort of an argument which reasons from the domestic to the international, there's limited play that can be achieved by pointing to all the juridical rights that we create within the context of the state. It seems to me that the argument is going to have to rest very heavily on this notion that there's something crucial about the fact that we act as temporary state officials rather than acting as self-defence, and that means that there should be certain privileges accruing to state officials. That seems to me quite a thin basis on which to develop the argument. Just a note, of course, it's also the case, which Malcolm doesn't look at, but that there are increasingly analogues to public authority at the international level. Right? There are increasingly analogues to punishment. So something like UN Security Council authorization of the use of application of sanctions, for example, does look like the beginnings of an analogue to rights of punishment at the domestic level. But that seems to me that we can't reason anything from that to justifying international humanitarian law in its current form. Okay, so my second sort of worry about the paper is that if we approach international humanitarian law by thinking about the ideal of the rule of law, then this question of standing becomes very important. And it seems to me that it's worth reflecting on why it is that we grant standing to state officials domestically. And it seems to me that the issue here is not simply a positive matter of law, but also a normative matter. So the argument is, roughly speaking, that in order to have an equal playing field, we need to create an equal playing field domestically in order to give everyone an equal opportunity to fulfill their individual flourishing. Right? So the normative goal here is to create the conditions of individual freedom. This is a sort of Kantian argument. The Kantian bit is sort of implicit, but it's kind of there. So there's a Kantian argument about the conditions of individual freedom. And the argument is that we need to create the state, right? We need to grant standing to these state officials in order to create precisely the equal opportunity to achieve our individual flourishing that we value. Okay, so the reason the standing of state officials is so important is because it creates something that is morally valuable to us. Right. So this is not just a sort of observation about what's positively the case in law, but also an argument about why we value the law being this way. Right. That's why it's so important. Now, when we move to the international level, the question is now becomes, well, if we take standing to be important and we observe, as Malcolm does, well, who are the actors that have standing? And we notice that it's states that have standing. We notice that state officials, therefore, have privileges. The argument seems to now go, well, you know, we should regard soldiers as having these privileges because standing is important in the law. But my thought here is, well, it's true as a matter of fact that states are the actors that have standing to negotiate at the international level. But what is the moral value that this promotes? Right? It's not obvious that the moral value that we're going to the moral value that is being promoted by international humanitarian law is something we should value. Right? If there is a value that we're going to look to protect on the international level, it presumably should be something like the fact that that individual soldiers and states aren't allowed to act unjustly. In other words, it's hard to understand. Malcolm wants to sort of defend international humanitarian law, defend the symmetry principle, the symmetry and independence of the jus in bello from the jus ad bellum. He wants to defend that by pointing to this consideration of standing. Well, but what is the moral value being defended here? It's not obvious to me that it's something we should value. So I think that the normative argument kind of gets lost. Right, and we need to hear what the normative argument is for believing that this standing in its current form is important. And I think that's tough. Right? So I think some bits of international humanitarian law, interestingly, you might want to retain. So when we were discussing this yesterday, there was a thought that so you can understand, for example, the prisoner of war regime from an argument about standing. The argument roughly being that states are fighting one another, a state captures an enemy combatant and judges that it doesn't have standing to prosecute them being a citizen of another country. Okay, so you can understand now how states might negotiate a kind of prisoner of war regime where they each hold prisoners of war, agree not to prosecute them, but simply to prevent them from fighting anymore. And how standing speaks to states, right? It's the fact that the states don't have standing to prosecute that's important here, and they come to this agreement. It seems to me this is something we might value. But states agreeing that the question of the justice of their cause is entirely irrelevant to what happens in war, seems to me it's not obvious what moral value is being promoted here by an argument from standing. So I think that the normative argument is kind of missing in the reasoning from standing. Let me just move on. In a sense, let me just add one thought to that, which is that I'm not very happy with the idea of war as a form of dispute resolution. It's not obvious to me that why we should think this is the case. It looks to me that what's permitted is really a form of tit for tat, and it's hard to know what the moral principle here is. Tit for tat is not a moral principle. What we get is a kind of permitted proportionate retaliation. That's kind of what international humanitarian law gives us, and I don't see what the argument is for that. Let me just open this up a bit more broadly and say that I think that, although I don't think the argument quite works, I think it raises these really interesting questions. One of them is about the boundary between self-defense and punishment, and the second is about the importance of standing. And it seems to me that, although I don't think Malcolm's argument quite works in its current form, that he is highlighting the fact that just war theory has some problems here, including, it seems to me, the sort of reductionist just war theory. Because it seems to me that the problem with symmetry, which is motivating, the problem with the symmetry and independence of international humanitarian law, or jus in bello from the jus ad bellum, which is sort of motivating this paper, arises from the idea that just wars are wars of self-defense, but that both sides can't be acting in self-defense. And that the way sort of reductionists tend to deal with this is by roughly accepting the jus ad bellum, by providing a reading of the jus ad bellum in terms of self-defense, and then taking issue with the jus in bello. And this is how the conflict gets generated. But it seems to me that actually, once we think carefully about the distinction between self-defense and punishment, which we're forced to when we turn to domestic criminal law, that there are various aspects of the jus ad bellum which don't look so defensible after all. So, for example, why is legitimate authority required to act in self-defense? Why is a declaration of war required to act in self-defense? Why is it that necessity last resort provisions aren't thought by some to apply to victims? Okay. It seems to me that actually there are various elements of the jus ad bellum which pretty much serve to permit something that looks rather more like proportionate retaliation than it does like pure self-defense. And that this is a problem on a kind of reductionist story as well, right? This isn't just a problem for kind of the old-fashioned just war theory. This is a problem for everybody about how we if you really, really want to think about pure self-defense, what is permitted? And it's a whole lot less than what is permitted by conventional readings of the jus ad bellum. Common idea is that 9/11 is legitimate grounds for self-defense. Well, if you're really thinking of pure self-defense terms, only if there's really, really compelling evidence of some kind of subsequent imminent threat. And it's not obvious that that's the case, if you ask me. Now, there may be all kinds of other reasons why resort to war is allowed in this situation. But it seems to be it's very easy to kind of tell yourself you're running a self-defense story, but actually on a narrow self-defense story, there's a kind of problem here. And that a lot of what is allowed is something more like proportionate retaliation. But I think Malcolm's paper also exposes sort of some of the problem here, which is that if we were to restrict war to pure self-defense and we were to lack any higher public authority, then you're kind of giving up the game to the bad guys, right? There is no way of keeping the bad guys in check. And it seems to me that this is why the question of standing becomes important, because in a way, I think the implication of Malcolm's argument, and it's interesting that he's got a Kantian kind of basis here, because I think this is sort of the implication of Kant's argument as well, is precisely about the need for more substantial forms of international public authority. So in other words, if you have more substantial forms of international public authority, then you really could run a purely self-defense account of war. But in the absence of forms of international public authority adequate to keep the most egregious offenders in bay, you have to let into your story about legitimate grounds of war something like kind of proportionate grounds for retaliation, which allow you to respond when you've been aggressed, even if there's not a kind of imminence about self-defense. And I think that's where the argument from standing points, right? So at the domestic level, the argument is that we can't do without a form of higher public authority. Malcolm wants to resist that on the international level, right? But as for Hobbes, as for this argument, I think the question is, why do you want to resist the implication of this on the international level, given that you accept the implication of it on the domestic level? Why don't we simply reason by analogy and say that just as we require on the domestic level a kind of higher public authority, why don't we reason at the international level and say, well, we require elements of international public authority? It doesn't have to be a sovereign, of course. Right? There's lots of kinds of international public authority that don't look like a sovereign, and personally I would prefer the ones that don't. But that seems to me where the argument points. If we were to do that, then of course it becomes much easier to restrict the residual right of self-defense to something that actually looks more like a residual right of self-defense, and therefore tracks the division you see in domestic criminal law more closely. Okay, I'll stop.
You're like right on time, so excellent.
I would like to begin also with a big thank you to Jonathan and to Helen for inviting me, and to all of you for what have already been a lot of illuminating conversations, and I hope that this will be the most illuminating, to me at least, of the whole event. In addition to the thanks, one other preliminary, and that is to say that this is also my first venture outside of the domestic borders of a single country, at least in my scholarship. I have left Canada before. But my focus on criminal law has been entirely in the domestic context. It has been on the structure of domestic criminal law within the context of a sovereign state and trying to understand it in that context. So I took it as a very significant challenge when asked to apply some of the ideas I developed in that context to a situation where, as Adam rightly points out, we do not have a world state. So the Republican congressmen can rest assured that that's okay. But we don't have that, and so we're not dealing with the same kind of normative framework that, at least on my account, turns so heavily on that assumption that where there is a public authority, they play a very special role in the domestic legal order. They can't play that. There is no such party in the international context. So that was the challenge that I set out to address. And of course, this is very preliminary. I'm sort of working out intuitions as to how this might apply in a new context. So I welcome your thoughts on how I might be able to develop it or what have you. Now, just in response to a couple of things that Adam raised, first, I just want to highlight the a couple of things that I think I'm not quite sure I agree with. So the one point that Adam raised, he had two areas where he was concerned. One was within the context of domestic criminal law, and the other was this question of standing internationally. In the domestic criminal law context, Adam suggested that that there's this big divide between self-defense and punishment, and that in the punishment context, this is where the real gap is between interpersonal morality and the structure of domestic criminal law. And so much of what follows came from that distinction, and I'm not sure that's true. In fact, I don't think it's true. If we look at the structure of the powers of public authorities in many, many places, whether it is to deal with civil order, whether it's emergency powers, there are just hundreds of places that have nothing to do with punishment where public authorities have significantly greater powers than private actors. And what that suggests to me is that the difference in the powers of state officials from private actors is not simply one relating to punishment. It has to do with its different standing with relationships of rights more generally. And so I think if the argument turns just on the special need for a state to engage in punishment, I think that I would resist that. I think that the state's special role extends to many places beyond that, most controversially even in the context of self-defense. Although, as I learned from conversations with some of you, apparently the idea that we need a public authority to act in defense of those who are under attack is an ancient one. That is, so the idea that it's a private right is not so intuitive and so eternal that I'm upsetting a shared conviction that everyone holds. In any case, so that's the first thing. The second thing was it was a suggestion that I was making an argument by analogy from the domestic context to the international context. And as you rightly say, the equal standing of individuals within the domestic context is a crucial concern for the kind of story I run. And it generates the need for having a public authority and so on. But the argument for why we need to treat the two belligerent parties in a war as equals, I didn't see it as simply by analogy to private individuals. Because I think you're right that the normative underpinnings for that argument just aren't there. Instead, My suggestion is not that states must have equal standing and therefore we must treat them equals and so on. In fact, were I to do that, I think I would lose one of the key conclusions I'm trying to draw here, which is that there's a big difference between war and crime. Right? And so that in the domestic context, there's no problem saying that there's a wrongful aggressor and an innocent defender, and that's not just a matter of interpersonal morality, that's something that's reflected in domestic criminal law. When this goes before the courts, there's no problem with drawing that distinction. The reason for why we treat the two belligerent parties as equals, at least in this one respect, that is that their soldiers carrying out the war are treated equally. I don't see it as running on the basis of an analogy to private persons, but rather turning crucially on the absence of a public authority over the two parties. So if that's the case, when there is a dispute as between those two parties, there needs to be some mechanism for its resolution, and it's precisely because there is no public authority to which we can appeal that the resort to war becomes necessary, and therefore the two parties must do what they need to do to resolve that dispute. That's where the equality comes from. It's not a rich sort of equality that they're entitled to, but rather sort of by the absence of anyone to distinguish between the rights authoritatively that it comes from. And this is mea culpa on the next point. I do make suggestions in the text of the paper where I suggest that I'm sympathetic to the tradition that sees war as a form of private dispute resolution. And to the extent that I do, that's simply my bad, as they say. What I meant to say, and what I ought to have said, is that on this model, the resort to war is a way of ending a dispute. To see it as a dispute resolution mechanism makes it look as though there's something like a judicial process without a judge, and that's not what I mean to get at, because that would suggest that somehow there's a dispute on the rights. Rather, it's just that we need to end the dispute such that it's possible that we can be able to resolve other matters on their rights afterwards. So it's a different kind of argument. And then finally, one last point, because I have a feeling that I'll learn more from you than the other way around. On the need for a public authority internationally, you suggest that my argument points in the direction of a need for a public authority internationally so that we can have the same kind of normative picture on the war stage that we do in domestic criminal law. And I guess what I'm suggesting here is that that certainly would change the normative framework, but even in the absence of an international public authority, we can make sense of the rights and wrongs of war, that there's a framework that we can bring from the domestic context to make sense of it. And I think that in the absence of an authoritative judge to distinguish the rights and wrongs of the belligerent parties, we can understand why those soldiers acting under otherwise legitimate orders to undertake the usual tasks of war, fighting against the soldiers on the other side, not to commit atrocities, not to attack civilians, not and so on, that they are just doing what's required to bring about a situation where we can have disputes resolved on their merits in the future. Let me stop there and open myself to questions.
Awesome. My job is shared, it's really easy. So I've got Daniel.